Viking, committed to exploring the world in comfort. Journey through the heart of Europe on an elegant Viking longship with thoughtful service, cultural enrichment, and all-inclusive fares. Discover more at Viking.com.
The June jobs report likely keeps the Fed on track to raise rates. And the White House says there's no pathway to a resolution in talks with Russia on a swap for Wall Street Journal reporter Evan Gerskovich as we mark the 100th day of his detention. Plus, why the world's autocrats are so resilient.
It's sort of emerged what I call sort of a regime playbook, sort of a best practices of repression. If you look at how mass protest movements are dealt with nowadays in these regimes, from Venezuela to Nicaragua to Iran, it looks quite similar.
It's Friday, July 7th. I'm Anne-Marie Fertoli for The Wall Street Journal. This is the PM edition of What's News, the top headlines and business stories that moved the world today. The major U.S. stock indexes slipped after data showed U.S. job growth cooled in June, though the unemployment rate remained historically low. The Labor Department reported that employers added 209,000 jobs to the economy, and the unemployment rate fell to 3.6%. Average hourly earnings grew 4.4% from a year earlier. Taken together, those results add to evidence that economic activity hasn't slowed as much as Fed officials expected, and leaves them likely to lift interest rates to a 22-year high at their meeting later this month. It has been 100 days since our colleague Evan Gerskovich was detained by Russia. Today, lawyers representing the publisher of The Wall Street Journal asked Mariana Katsarova, the United Nations human rights advocate in Russia, to press Moscow for his release. Gerskovich was detained by Russia's Federal Security Service while on a reporting trip and is being held on an allegation of espionage. He, the Journal, and the U.S. government vehemently deny the allegation. The Biden administration says he has been wrongfully detained, is not a spy, and has never worked for the government. During a White House press briefing this afternoon, National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan spoke about the administration's efforts to release Evan and Paul Whelan, a former U.S. Marine that the U.S. considers to be unlawfully held in Russia.
It is true, and we have said that we remain in contact with Russian authorities at high levels on these cases to try to figure out a way to bring unjustly detained Americans home, including Evan. We have also made clear for months now, even before Evan was detained, as we were dealing with Paul Whelan, that we are prepared to do hard things in order to get our citizens home, including getting Evan home. I do not want to give false hope. What the Kremlin said earlier this week is correct. There have been discussions. But those discussions have not produced a clear pathway to a resolution. And so I cannot stand here today and tell you that we have a clear answer to how we are going to get Evan home. All I can do is tell you that we have a clear commitment and conviction that we will do everything possible to bring him home.
You can read more about Evan on our website, wsj.com. Despite the biggest challenge to his authority in more than two decades, Russian President Vladimir Putin withstood the rebellion of the Wagner mercenary group and remains in power. It's a sign of the resiliency of autocracies across the globe that are increasingly cooperating with each other to counter the West. Joining me now with more on what's giving the world's autocracies such staying power is our UK bureau chief, David Luno. Hi, David. Welcome to What's News.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Let's start with Putin. The Wagner rebellion posed a threat to his grip on power, but ultimately ended with a truce and Putin remaining president. What can we make of that?
Well, it tells us that autocrats or dictators or strongmen, whatever you want to call them, are very difficult to dislodge from power. Now, very often, you know, these kinds of regimes and strongmen start off quite slowly. They win democratic elections in a lot of cases. Putin came to power at roughly the same time as Venezuela's late strongman, Hugo Chavez. They both won democratic elections, in both cases at a time when voters in their countries were super fed up with the existing system, which they saw as corrupt and incompetent. So they both had a mandate for change, which gave them kind of a freer hand to start concentrating power. But over time, it's a bit like the frog in the boiling water. You suddenly wake up one day, and while there still may be elections, they aren't free and fair. The opposition is a shadow of what it was. The media has been hounded out of the country. Any powerful business figures have been jailed or exiled, and most of the courts and the armies are stacked with your cronies. So when you get to that point, change suddenly looks quite difficult. So even if they become unpopular and you have protest movements, they can get snuffed out pretty quickly if the regime kind of holds their nerve and uses repression. So that sort of only leaves the guys with guns as an option to kicking an autocrat out of power. In the case of Russia, I think that's what made the Wagner rebellion so interesting. It was guys with guns. At the end of the day, however, Putin is still there. He's probably since then been purging anyone who might have shown their hand to be against him. And if history is any guide, he could be in power for a very long while still.
So you did mention some of the commonalities across different autocracies. I'm wondering, among those across the world that are showing staying power or resiliency, are there other aspects that they share in common that are allowing them to survive?
Yeah, I mean, in the 80s and 90s, sort of when I was growing up, there was a real wave of democratization. The last real surge we saw of these was sort of the Arab Spring and the color revolutions in former Soviet republics like Ukraine in the 2000s. But since then, it really feels like autocrats have kind of gotten the upper hand. I think they got scared of those revolts and they started learning how best to adapt. I think images like former Libyan dictator Muammar Gaddafi being bludgeoned in the streets by an angry mob really frightened them. And we know from many reports that this frightened Putin personally. So they've all started sort of cooperating a lot more. And it's sort of emerged what I call sort of a regime playbook, sort of a best practices of repression. I'll just say one last factor that's kind of caused autocrats to have more staying power these days is there's no real graceful exit anymore. In the past, you'd have guys like Ferdinand Marcos or Haiti dictator Baby Doc Duvalier going off into some kind of comfortable exile. But with the rise of the International Criminal Court, you know, you had Slobodan Milosevic facing court in The Hague. You had Pinochet, the Chilean dictator, facing criminal charges. So suddenly, with that exit blocked, these guys have their backs against the wall, and they're going to fight to the death. So it makes it a little bit more difficult.
Right, and to that point, we have seen autocracies that have been toppled. The Arab Spring comes to mind. What else made those efforts successful? Are there similarities we can draw despite geographic differences across the world?
Yeah, studies have shown that it's a little bit easier to create change in an autocracy that's built around a party, say like a communist party, or an institution of some kind, a royal family, kings, monarchies, than it is around autocracies built around personalities. I would add one more thing. It's interesting on the institutionalized autocracies versus personalized ones that China has transitioned in the last 5 or 6 years from an institutional autocracy under the Communist Party to a personalized one under Xi Jinping. That's a very notable development in the world and the one that needs to be carefully watched.
Wall Street Journal UK Bureau Chief David Luno, thank you so much.
It's been a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Coming up, we'll explain how China's new restrictions on two minerals you've probably never heard of are sending a warning to the U.S. That's after the break.
This message comes from Viking, committed to exploring the world in comfort. Journey through the heart of Europe on an elegant Viking longship with thoughtful service, destination-focused dining, and cultural enrichment on board and on shore. And every Viking voyage is all-inclusive with no children and no casinos. Discover more at Viking.com.
In other news, China's financial technology giant Ant Group, associated with billionaire Jack Ma, has been fined close to $1 billion by the country's financial regulators, who accused it of having violated many laws and regulations. The company said it would comply with the terms of the penalty. The fine is the latest in a string of large penalties that have been imposed on China's internet giants since the government's broad regulatory crackdown began in late 2020. Meanwhile, we've been reporting on What's News about restrictions the U.S. has placed on China's semiconductor industry, as America looks to boost chip production at home. This week, China announced its latest move in the battle for dominance in the chip industry: export restrictions on two minerals, gallium and germanium. One analyst told my colleague John Emont that it's a warning shot to the U.S., from the country that controls the minerals that run the world. John is here with me now to explain. John, I had never heard of these minerals before this week. Maybe some of our listeners are in that same boat. Why are they so important?
Right. Well, I can begin with a confession, which is that I also hadn't heard of these two minerals prior to this week. This short answer is they're not extremely important. They have uses in key technologies like semiconductors. They're not major minerals, but China dominates their production. And so when China this week put export controls on the minerals, it indicated that they could do it for other minerals that might that are even more important for global trade and for global manufacturing. And so that's why this was so concerning for many people in industry and government in the West.
So why is China taking these steps? What are they trying to accomplish here?
What is clear is that there's a very intense trade standoff between the U.S. and China. And the U.S. has taken recent steps to restrict the export of advanced chips and equipment to make advanced chips to China. And China interprets this as an effort by the U.S. to handicap its industry and its ambitions to become a, you know, a high-tech powerhouse. So in this very tense atmosphere, China appears to be indicating that it has cards to play too. And one of its cards is that it controls a vast supplies and a vast production of these critical minerals.
What can the West do to respond? Are there other sources to tap of these minerals?
Yes, absolutely. So a lot of these minerals are found quite plentiful and are found in many different countries. Something like lithium is found all over the world. So it's just a matter of mobilizing funding and mobilizing expertise to actually tap these resources. However, China has really cornered the market in terms of processing for many years now. It's not necessarily the most inviting environment for firms to dive in and try to produce these minerals themselves, because if they can't compete with China on cost and prices aren't extremely high thanks to the amount of Chinese production, then it might not actually be that economically viable. So that's why Western governments are stepping in and trying to push companies to actually do this. And there have been lots of recent legislation in the United States to try to encourage companies to actually process minerals locally or to buy minerals that are processed by allies.
That was Wall Street Journal reporter John Emont. And finally, this week, the Journal podcast began running a new limited series. It's called With Great Power, The Rise of Superhero Cinema. The four-part series examines the influence of superhero movies, tracking the history of a small, troubled comics publisher to what's now big business in Hollywood. The final episode of the series will be available on Sunday. The host is Ben Fritz, our West Coast bureau chief, who's here now to talk about it. Hi, Ben.
Hey, Anne-Marie.
So I think we've all seen a glut of superhero movies over the past few years, also on streaming networks. What sparked the idea for this podcast series? What did you want to explore here?
Well, you know, I feel like everybody has a strong opinion about these movies and now TV shows, right? They either love them. A lot of people, it's the only reason they go to multiplexes anymore. They can't get enough of the MCU, Marvel Cinematic Universe. And some people are like, oh my God, it's so oppressive. What happened to all the other kinds of movies I used to like? Why is this all anybody talks about? And I wanted to find out how that happened. And of course, since I'm a Wall Street Journal editor and former reporter, my instinct is to say, well, what's the business story? How did this becomes such a dominant part of the entertainment industry? And I started digging into it, and it turns out it's a really great business story. And if you understand the business, then you understand why we have so many of these movies and TV shows.
So in talking about the business, is this primarily a Marvel-DC battle, or are we seeing other smaller companies getting into this game, especially because it's such big business?
Well, for superhero movies, it's very much a Marvel-DC battle, and the podcast is in large part about how Marvel has won that battle, which was very unlikely. 25 years ago, Marvel was a bankrupt company, literally. Nobody took it seriously. The idea that they could make their own movie seemed laughable. And DC had the better-known superheroes. Nobody had heard of Iron Man. Everybody knew Superman and Batman, you know? So nobody would have predicted what would happen with Marvel becoming not just the bigger superhero movie company, but really the most successful movie studio of the 21st century. I mean, by far. Everybody else is trying to copy what Marvel has done, but nobody's been as successful.
So without giving too much away here, what were your main takeaways from approaching this as a business story?
What was amazing to me is I think you look at it now and you're like, of course this was going to happen. Comic books have been around for nearly 100 years. They have all these great stories to adapt. Superheroes are so iconic. But it wasn't an inevitable story at all. And there were a lot of random kind of funny things along the way. Just to give you one of my favorite details is Donald Trump has two cameos in this podcast. What does Donald Trump have to do with the Marvel Cinematic Universe? You'll have to listen to find out, but it's very weird.
That's Wall Street Journal West Coast Bureau Chief Ben Fritz, who hosts our new limited series, With Great Power, The Rise of Superhero Cinema. You can find it on our website, wsj.com/podcasts. And that's what's news for this week. Our hosts are me, Anne-Marie Fertoli, and Luke Vargas. The show was produced by Pierre Bien-Aimé and Kate Bullivant, with help from Mohsen Ali, Anthony Bansi, Julie Chang, Zoe Thomas, and J.R. Whalen, and editorial support from Sandra Kilhoff, Michael Cosmides, Catherine Millsop, Philana Patterson, and Chris Sinsley. If you like what you hear, please rate and review us. We'll be back on Monday morning. Thanks for listening.
This message comes from Viking, committed to exploring the world in comfort. Journey through the heart of Europe on an elegant Viking longship with thoughtful service, destination-focused dining, and cultural enrichment on board and on shore. And every Viking voyage is all-inclusive with no children and no casinos. Discover more at Viking.com.